Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on Monday, the 26th of March, the year 2012. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll find out about Wednesday's Men's Health Forum with guests Ruth Johnson and Alex Viteri. Ken Fix will be here with a preview of Tuesday's Planetarium presentation. Scott Chambor will highlight Alaska's housing stock and homelessness. Jenny Frimlin from Alaska Litho will be here with news about an upcoming training seminar. I'll also talk with Brandon Demery and Art Roach about this weekend's performances of the play, I Am My Own Wife. That writer's on my neck for a note, music and more today at 3 on a Juneau afternoon.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Lawmakers are sitting on pins and needles as the Supreme Court takes up the health care law this week. Democrats pass the law and Republicans want it overturned. Matt Laszlo reports on how the case could impact Native Americans.
About a third of Native Americans who aren't eligible for Medicare are uninsured, which the new health care law would change by expanding Medicaid and requiring people to get insurance. But 26 states are challenging the law. The arguments are simple, yet also complex. First, the simple. Opponents, such as Washington Republican Doc Hastings, say it's an overreach for the government to force people to purchase health insurance under the law.
Well, I think that the coalition of 26 states have a very, very solid case.
Now the complexity. California Democrat John Garamendi says because health care makes up about one-fifth of the U.S. economy, the court ought to rule that it's within Congress's power to regulate commerce.
We think we have a strong argument under the Commerce Clause as a result of this is national. These issues move across state lines, and health care is not just a local issue. It is a national issue.
Then there's the politics of the law and the court. Democrats disagree with what they say are recent politicized court decisions. And Republicans have been using the president's signature legislative accomplishment to unravel his support. While talk of repeal makes good campaign rhetoric, it's much harder for the GOP to carry through within Washington. That's why the party has so much riding on the Supreme Court case. But California Republican Wally Herger says even if the court upholds the law, his party isn't letting up.
Oh, it's not our last stand. No, we'll keep going. I mean, this is very unpopular. This is very harmful to health care. We're not going to stop until we have it completely repealed.
Congress will be active this week, but every lawmaker will have one eye across the street on the majestic pillars of the court. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Colorado's two federally recognized tribes now have permanent flags on display in the state capitol, a step the tribes and state say helps improve the government-to-government relationship. KUNC's Kirk Ziegler reports.
Governor John Hickenlooper joined tribal council leaders from the Southern Ute and Ute Mountain Ute tribes to install two flags here in the echoing halls of the Colorado Capitol. In a short speech, the governor called on the state to do more, to work with the two tribes on economic development and other issues. Both are now one of the largest employers in the Four Corners region. Casinos and a ramp-up in energy development have been key in boosting the economy in one of the state's traditionally poorest areas. Ute Mountain Ute Tribal Councilman Manuel Hart made the 7-hour drive up to Denver for the ceremony, which he called historic.
Today we heard thunder come from the southwest from the two tribes that are recognized, state of Colorado, Ute Mountain and Southern Ute. So in the halls of Capitol in Denver, there was thunder from the two tribes, and it was a really good feeling.
Hart wishes the flags could have been installed sooner, but he says the state of Colorado has come a long way, noting its first territorial governor prominently called for the eradication of all Native Americans from this part of the country in the late 1800s. For National Native News, I'm Kirk Ziegler in Denver.
A flooded First Nation in Manitoba, Canada could be salvaged. Members may not have to be moved to a new community. A government report is being worked on for the Lake St. Martin First Nation. Residents were evacuated to hotels last spring, where many are still living. On this day in 1933, author, lawyer, and champion of American Indian rights, Vine Deloria Jr. was born. He was well known for his book, Custer Died for Your Sins, an Indian Manifesto. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
Support for National Native News comes from the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use PIP, CLIP, GIVE when filing online for your PFD. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:06 and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our first guest is Ken Fix from the Meridic Planetarium here to talk about Hades, Pluto, and Trans-Neptunian objects, whatever they are. Ken, thank you very much for coming down the show today.
Thanks for having me again, Jeff. This is a day early because we usually do these on Tuesday, the day of the show, but we just wound up doing this one today.
So let's talk about tonight. What can people see when they look up in the sky in a clear night like tonight?
Very prominently, you'll probably see the planets Jupiter and Venus. Venus will be on the top. Jupiter will be a little bit lower. They're very bright and prominent in the sky, and you'll probably also see Mars a little later in the evening.
And you can tell they're planets because they're just so much brighter than the stars?
Yes, and plus you'll see a little bit more movement with them versus the stars.
The show is happening tonight outside, so take a look at it when it gets finally dark. I'm not sure which time since it is this evening.
Well, it's probably about 8:30 or a little bit beyond that.
So tomorrow night you're going to be talking about Hades, Pluto, and trans-Neptunian objects. Can you describe the show, please?
Well, I'm finishing some of the subjects in my Myth and the Planet series, but I'll be covering the god Hades, who is god of the underworld in Greek mythology, and I'll also be covering Pluto, the ninth planet discovered that got recently demoted a few years ago by the International Astronomical Union.
Tell us more about the demotion process.
Well, Pluto didn't follow the rules. They established rules for planets. Imagine that the sun is the center of a merry-go-round, and the rest of the planets kind of go up and down a little bit like the horses. Well, Pluto's orbit does nothing like that. It orbits from about 22 degrees above to 22 degrees below that merry-go-round type plane.
How come it took so long to find out and destroy so many people's myths and beliefs?
Well, because they started to find other objects out past the orbit of Pluto that also do not follow the planetary rules. It was basically a planet named Eris, which was discovered in 2006, that sort of wrecked that for Pluto. Eris is actually bigger than Pluto. It orbits further out, and it's also inclined over 50 degrees to the galactic plane. But it's because these planetary objects are small and do not sweep their orbits of debris. That's one of the reasons that the definitions wound up downgrading Pluto, along with these other dwarf planets that are out beyond the orbit of Neptune.
And what is a trans-Neptunian object?
That's those dwarf planets. They're called trans-Neptunian objects, TNOs.
I like TNO better. It's easier to say.
Yeah, but there's several of them out there. Eris, Makemake, Hamina. There's about nine of them now, so they're actually at the point where their discoveries have outnumbered our traditional planets that we know of, the main eight now.
Tell us a little about the gods Pluto and Hades.
Well, Hades, Pluto was the name in Roman mythology for Hades, but it started in Greek mythology. Hades was one of the brothers of Zeus, the other one being Poseidon. But when they divided up the entire domain of existence, once Zeus and his brothers had defeated Cronos in the Battle of the Olympians and the Titans, Hades was given control of the underworld, or the land of the dead. So a lot of people confuse Hades with the devil. They are not the same thing. They are two vastly different things. The devil is Lucifer, and that's from Christianity. And Hades was not the devil. He didn't show up and coerce people into doing bad things or whatever. He just presided over the land of the dead, and that's where your soul went to after you ended your mortal existence.
Well, what would be the difference between Hades and Pluto? Are they just in names, and do they have different types of mythology?
No, that's pretty much the only difference, is that they changed the name when they went from Greek mythology. When the Romans adopted the Greek pantheon of gods, they just changed all of the names and adopted all of the myths that were in existence except for Apollo. Apollo is the same name in Greek mythology as it is in Roman mythology. That's the only one that didn't change.
What is that?
I don't know. I have no idea why they changed everybody else, but they didn't change him.
You're talking about Hades, Pluto, and trans-Neptunian objects tomorrow night at 6:30 at the planetarium?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about Hades, if you could, please.
Well, one of the most widely told myths about Hades was that he had kidnapped the daughter of Demeter, who was Persephone. And Demeter was the goddess of the seasons. And he abducted her and wanted her for his bride, took her into the underworld. And once she ate a pomegranate seed there, she was destined to stay there. And, of course, Demeter was wandering the world, trying to figure out where her daughter went to. And once she found out that Hades had her, she threatened to turn the entire world to winter and kill everything. Well, Zeus had to broker a deal between the two, and it was agreed that Demeter would get her daughter above the earth for two-thirds of the year, and Hades would have her for the other third of the year, and that's how the Greeks explained the change of the seasons.
Mm. How far away is Pluto?
It's over 2.9 billion miles, so it's way out there, and of course it wasn't discovered until 1930.
What's the farthest we've been able to send an unmanned space object?
Well, we have two probes right now that are further out than Pluto, definitely. Voyagers 1 and 2. Voyager exited the plane of the ecliptic, or that big imaginary merry-go-round that circles the sun, to the north. And Voyager 2 is going straight out past that. But they're entering what's called the heliopause. That's the point at which the sun's energy loses any effect, and they're actually beginning to enter interstellar space.
Ken Fix will be talking about planetarium stuff, Hades, Pluto, and trans-Neptunian objects tomorrow night at 6:30 at the Meridic Planetarium. For people who don't know how to go, could you direct them, please?
Yes, we're on Glacier Highway. If you know where Blockbuster is, we're just past that. And we're in the Marie Drake Middle School building just before the fences start for the soccer fields.
Otherwise, they should look up in the sky tonight for what planets?
You'll primarily be seeing Jupiter, and above that will be Venus.
All right. Ken Fix, thank you for coming by. Is there anything like that I might have forgotten to ask?
No, Jeff, that's pretty much it, but thanks for having me again. And again, that show is tomorrow night, not tonight. Usually I do these talks on the day of the show, but in this case we didn't. So it's tomorrow night at 6:30 at the Murray Drake Planetarium.
Ensemble. The time is 3:15, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Next guests are Alex Viteri and Ruth Johnson here to talk about Wednesday's Men's Health Forum, run by Cancer Connection and Bartlett Regional Hospital. Alex and Ruth, thank you very much for being on the air today with us.
Hi. It's great to be here.
So in a nutshell, what is the Men's Health Forum, Alex?
Well, the Men's Health Forum is an annual event sponsored by Cancer Connection and others that helps men understand how to take better care of themselves, both from a prevention aspect as well as from a getting better health-wise aspect.
And what is the theme for this year?
This year's theme is going to be presented by Dr. Ferguson, and the theme is the mechanics of wellness, keeping your engine running smoothly.
Tell me a little bit about Dr. Ferguson, if you could, please.
Yeah, Dr. Ferguson is the director of wellness for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Corporation up in Anchorage. He's a long history of, he's a naturopathic doctor. He comes to us from the Aleutian chain, by the way. So he's put himself through school, got himself a nice degree, is highly recognized in the field of naturopathic medicine. He made a number of presentations. In fact, he was here the 25th of May last year at the Diabetes Conference. Made a presentation there on how to take better care of yourself food-wise.
He'll be talking about the mechanics of health?
Yes, that's correct.
Hmm.
He'll be talking about things like herbal medicines, what's good for you, what don't take, what not to take when you're on other medications, and how to take advantage of exercise and make yourself younger.
What are the top five reasons men should go?
I was hoping you would ask. The top five reasons are, first of all, it's real good, healthy snack food, which is brought to us by Abby's Kitchen. Thank you, Abby. They're one of our sponsors. To improve your health, getting yourself healthier, better, making your engine running smoother, getting your vascular system improved, your heart running better, your physique in better shape. A lot of good company there. There'll be a lot of us older gentlemen there. And also to learn more about Cancer Connection, which is one of the prime sponsors.
Ruth, you want to talk about Cancer Connection for a minute or so?
Sure, Jeff. Cancer Connection has been around since mid-90s. We were founded by Mike Miller, who was diagnosed with a very advanced form of prostate cancer. And I'm always happy to report he's doing very well. He relocated to Oregon a few years ago, but Cancer Connection has carried on in his absence, and we've grown quite a bit since Mike left. We have some exciting new programs, actually, we've added just in the last year or so. I think the one we're most pleased about, and I look forward to talking a little bit about at the forum, is Cancer Connection actually now has an apartment for people to stay in when they're being treated for cancer in Seattle. We try and keep it available mostly for people who have to be out of town for, you know, longer extended periods of time for radiation therapy. We've had people who need to be in Seattle for 6 weeks, and you can imagine how expensive that is. So we offer the apartment. It's fully furnished with laundry, dryer, washer, dryer, kitchen. It's much more than a hotel room, and it's within walking distance to most of the main hospitals. And we've even had to scholarship it a couple of times for people. We already subsidize travel up to about $35,000 a year in travel subsidies for people, but the one thing we could never help people with is where to stay when they're in Seattle. A plane ticket is one thing, but where are you going to live for a month in a city that expensive? So we're pretty excited that we're at least able to help one person at a time with that new program this year.
And how are you funded?
We're funded 100% by donations.
So if people would like to donate, what's the mailing address? They could mail a check to?
P.O. Box 20329, Juneau 99802.
Talking with Alex Viteri and Ruth Johnson about Wednesday's Men's Health Forum, which starts at 4:30. Should women go?
Absolutely. We always say women come with your husbands, husbands come with your wives at both men's and women's health forums. We try and target them, the men's to the men's specific issues, women's to women's, but our bodies have a lot more in common, and we all benefit from the health education we try to bring to down. We've had some comments, actually, at the Women's Health Forum last year that I'll grab a minute to address that sometimes our attendees wish we would talk about something more than cancer, and we do try to do that. You know, most of our funding is for cancer programs. Our support is for cancer patients. But particularly with programs like this with Dr. Ferguson, we do target overall health because a healthy body will fight cancer. The heart-healthy diet is the cancer-healthy diet. We do try in all of our forums to talk about more than just cancer.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the heart-healthy diet?
Oh, we think I'll let Dr. Ferguson do that, but there are a lot of similarities. We had Dr. Moyad here a few years ago who made that point that, you know, if you're worried about staying on topic with cancer because that's your organization all the time, have no fear. And we heard the same thing at Women's Health Forum. Dr. Pujari kind of said the same thing. This is your guidelines to have to prevent cancer, but really this is the heart healthy diet too. This is the keep your engine running smoothly diet, not just the cancer prevention diet. And it's not just diet. He'll be talking about exercise, lifestyles.
He said the keynote in the Great Food by Abby's Kitchen. What else is going to be happening at the Men's Health Forum on Wednesday?
Well, that's about it. The Men's Health Forum is a smaller program than the Women's Health Forum. You know, the Women's Health Forum, we have a whole community full of exhibitors there. But the Men's Health Forum is just a smaller topic with a Q&A afterwards. And sometimes the guys do stay and find that they have a lot of questions. And so it can go on for quite a while after we've closed the doors. But Bartlett Regional Hospital and their some of their clinicians will have some information booths there. Cancer Connection will be there. But really the focus is the keynote speaker, a wonderful, healthy spread of food from Abby's Kitchen, and bring your questions.
Yeah, we've learned over the last number of men's health forums that the more questions and answers, the more you learn after the presentation. The key here, though, the general message of the men's health forum, I'm glad you mentioned, should men bring their wives and, you know, their other significant others. I really want to encourage the female population of Juneau to grab the male and bring him to this, because men seem to be a little reluctant to come to these things. I've been for years trying to convince Men's Health Forum that they ought to just serve beer and wine. They'd show up, like, we couldn't keep them away.
You got me.
But there's something contradictory about that and the message we're trying to send. So it's just the wrong message. But that's the mentality. So we're looking here for the men. You can see the name, the talk itself, the mechanics of wellness, keeping your engine running smoothly. We're looking for the Sunday afternoon football player, the guy who sits on his sofa all day long. Let's get him to this and help him understand that people my age, and I'm well over my prime, can understand that we can still keep youthful, we can still keep our energy levels high, we can still be healthy, just by taking good care of ourselves. You don't let your car engine run out of oil, you know. You change your spark plugs when you need it.
Oh.
Yeah, well, most of us try not to. And that general maintenance, our engine is just as important as our cars, and we ought to be focusing on our engines.
Is there a website that can get more information about the Men's Health Forum?
Yeah, I would recommend going to the web. Our website is World Wide Web, cancerconnectionak.com.
.org,
I'm sorry. Thank you, Ruth. .org. They'll find out more about the Men's Health Forum there. It's a great place to go to if you want to make a donation. And it lists our board members as well as all our program activities and when they occur. So in August, we have the women's...
the Beat the Odds race.
The Beat the Odds race. And then the Ladies' Health Forum is October 20th.
We mentioned the top ed.
We also have National Cancer Survivors Day, June 3rd, I believe.
That's correct.
June 2nd or 3rd.
We talked about the five reasons men should go. What do you think are a few of the reasons men don't go? What kind of excuses do they have?
Okay, well, it's after work and they're tired. There's something else on television. They have to go to the store. I can make up as many excuses as I want to. When my wife wants me to do something, I always have a reason not to go. So it's the same sort of thing. But I think the real thing that we're trying to get is to encourage them inside themselves to understand that they do have a really good reason to go. Taking care of yourself is important. Learning how to do it the right way, it's not that hard. On television, you see all these advertisements about drugs that you take this pill and you lose weight, take that pill and you do this, eat this food and you're going to be healthy. This one's got anti-this and something's got pro-that. It gets a little confusing and you kind of want to walk away from all that. But the real world is people like Dr. Ferguson who can come in and say, here's the right way to do it. It's really simple. It's not that complicated. There are these really good medicines for you, these good herbs for you. To keep it simple, it's not that hard. The way you take care of your heart is the same way you take care of yourself recovering from cancer. I'm a perfect example of that. You can be active and live a really good free life if you just encourage yourself to do it.
Men's Health Forum starts at 4:30 at Centennial Hall, and it's absolutely free. How long do you think it's going to go for?
Well, we open the doors at 4:30. That's when you can start eating the snacks. The presentation starts at 5, and usually the talk is over around 6:30, and question and answers will probably go through to about 7:30, 8 o'clock, as long as there are questions.
Alex Vitteri and Ruth Johnson, thank you so much for coming down to the station and talking about the Men's Health Forum, starting Wednesday at 4:30 at Centennial Hall. Again, it's absolutely free. There's no excuse not to go. Is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
No. Thank you for having us, Jeff.
Thank you for having us.
And you are tuned to KTOO News and Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guest is Scott Chambord. He's a planner with an advisory board on alcoholism. He'll be speaking at a brown bag lunch on homelessness this Wednesday at the Alaska State Museum. Scott, thank you very much for coming down.
Great, thanks, Jeff.
Your talk is going to be Alaska's inadequate housing stock. Can you quantify what you mean by inadequate?
Sure. I think, as co-chair of the Juneau Homeless Coalition, one of the things we really want to look into is the actual amount of affordable housing stock that is within the community. And I think when you take a look at the issue and think about how housing is thought of, it's either single-family homes or apartment rentals, and there's a much deeper connection of overlapping types of housing units that need to be looked at. There's a kind of if you think of a Venn diagram, you have a whole set of affordable housing stock, which includes your emergency shelters, your transitional living, your assisted living, overlaps with the fair market rental units and home ownership. And then thrown in that kind of overlapping section in the middle is the strategies of, housing choice, rental vouchers, and rental assistance that is kind of an assisted way to get low-income families or persons into housing that is on the fair market.
Would you say the answer is just to build?
And I think, you know, the part of my talk is going to talk about, you know, the answer is going to be different to each community. In Juneau, having done work on our Juneau housing needs assessment and taking a look at our local market, you know, the answer is to build not only of the affordable housing stock, you know, places like St. Vincent de Paul, Aware, to get more permanent supportive housing, more potential shelter space within that affordable stock, but also the fair market, because there's not an adequate enough of like filtering down so that we have the flexibility and resources to get low-income folks into more appropriate housing.
How does it all affect the middle class?
The middle class, I think you see that at the top end. If you kind of look at the amount of building units within town, it's simply an affordability issue for folks who are middle income or perhaps in their entry-level jobs, whereas for the homeless population, the housing situation is one, availability, two, lack of supports, and then three, you know, affordability.
How does Juneau compare with other communities of its size across the country?
So Juneau is kind of in a unique circumstance. Having looked at this for a number of years now, I think it's probably one of the more difficult housing markets in the country. The lack of a road system really takes away a solution that a lot of other communities have, which is bedroom communities, which will have, you know, more affordable housing as well as higher vacancy rates. You know, basically, we're confined to the housing stock that we have, and you see that, you know, the affordable housing stock is all utilized. There's long wait lists, and there's 1% vacancy rates. The housing choice vouchers, we don't have enough to serve the people who are on those wait lists. And then, like I said, the vacancy rates within the fair market are low for, you know, a community of this size.
Well, there is land out there, just it's not being developed.
Exactly, and I think that would be, you know, the encouragement to help, you know, basically all populations up through the middle class is to build more units of a varied size and higher density and more on transportation lines.
As weather improves, can we expect a rise in the number of homeless people?
You know, I don't potentially. I don't think that we've seen that as a coalition. We have a couple strategies as a homeless coalition. We do our annual point-in-time count in January, and then the final numbers on that survey, as well as the surveys that go out to the affordable housing stock and the school district, come together some point in May. Last year, we had 562 people who were homeless at that time in January. We haven't done a point-in-time count in the summertime for many years. They used to do them, I think, around the turn of the century. So we don't really know for sure, but anecdotally, I think service providers would say that you see some more transient population, people come in for work who perhaps didn't get it and find themselves stuck.
In the meantime, what's being done to mitigate the problem of homelessness?
Well, the Juneau Homeless Coalition has been really active. Like I say, you know, the last 3 years, we've been really put a lot of stock into that point-in-time homeless count so that we can accurately, you know, explain, you know, the numbers that we're seeing. The big initiative and push that we're doing right now is to focus on kind of a subpopulation of the homeless here in Juneau, and that is the chronic, inebriate, hard-to-house homeless. And so the Homeless Coalition has been meeting since this on this specific population September, and we did an original little survey to all of the persons who are interested and see that population on a routine basis, asking two questions. You know, what are the numbers of that population, and how much is it costing in terms of service, cleanup, police calls, et cetera. And so we put that little summary together, and we're able to come up with a kind of an idea that we're talking anywhere from 25 to 40, you know, hard-to-house, chronic inebriates who are living on the streets. And, you know, the cost estimates are pretty severe because folks like that tend to use a lot of services. And so the coalition has parlayed that sort of initial discussion into a $10,000 or a $20,000 Mental Health Trust Authority grant to for an outreach coordinator at the Glory Hole so that we can actually go out and do an outreach survey, what's called a vulnerability index survey. and we're actually going to have a big training. We have 40 volunteers this evening at Northern Lights Church kind of getting trained on how to go about doing that street outreach survey. And the next 3 days, we're going to be going out to every aspect of the community to engage and talk with, you know, folks who are living on the street.
I'm talking to Scott Chambord. He's a planner with the Advisory Board on the State of Alcoholism for the State of Alaska. You're delivering a brown bag lunch talk this Wednesday at the Alaska State Museum right about noon. Scott, what are you going to be talking about?
So this series of lectures kind of came out of our annual Out of the Rain calendar that we've done for 7 years. It's kind of the advocacy piece of the Homeless Coalition. And this year we were fortunate to parlay that into a State of Alaska State Museum exhibit. And so it's been running since the beginning of the month, and it goes through April 14th. And along with that, we've had a series of discussions to talk about the various faces of homelessness and the various populations here in town. Previous talks were by Dan Austin at St. Vincent de Paul to talk about the age of the silver tsunami, the older folks that he is starting to see that are homeless in the coming wave of greater homelessness above the Asian. The Juneau School District homeless liaison spoke about youth homelessness. Right now, there are over 100 youth within the school district that are homeless. And then last week, Manu O'Neill at AWARE talked about domestic violence and its role in homelessness. So I'm following it up with kind of the answer, which is, you know, we need more flexibility within our housing stock to satisfy all of these needs of the folks that we're seeing.
And I understand you and Mandy were having a friendly competition.
We were. You know, we knew we were the last two on the docket, so we're trying to recruit as many folks to attend our sessions as possible. So I was not in town last week, so I haven't gotten a word on how successful hers was. So I'm hoping to top it.
You can help Scott top it by going to the meeting this Wednesday at noon at the Alaska City Museum. Scott, anything you'd like to add that I might have forgotten to ask?
No, I think if anybody's interested in learning more about the Homeless Coalition, you can contact Jordan Nigro at SAIL or myself at the State of Alaska. Very busy time. And I also want to say, you know, our coordinator, Kyle Rennick, who's putting together this vulnerability index survey that we're going to be doing throughout the community this week, has done just a bang-up job to get this organized within about a month and a half. And like I say, we have fantastic support from the community to help us go out and do that. And, you know, all of the things that we have put on recently, you know, are really supported by our volunteers. So we appreciate that.
And, Scott, you're familiar with a woman who just recently passed away?
Yes. Gloria Plummer passed away last week. I was actually out of town and saw the newspaper articles. And obviously she was living under the bridge here in downtown. And that is a person we would likely have surveyed in the next few days to figure out, you know, how vulnerable living on the street has been for her. You know, our whole goal is to have kind of a registry of folks that we need to try and get services and get housed, you know, immediately. And so it was likely that we would have talked to her.
And to close out this part of the show, let's feature a moment of silence for Gloria. Scott, thank you very much for coming down to the station and talking.
Great. Thank you, Jeff.
The Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 26th of March, 2012. It's the birthday of A.E. Housman, born Worcestershire, England, 1859, the poet who gave us the lines, "Loveliest of trees, the cherry now is hung with bloom along the bough and stands about the woodland ride wearing white for Eastertide." It's the birthday of Tennessee Williams, Columbus, Mississippi, 1911, wanted to become a playwright when he was 18 and saw a production of Ibsen's Ghosts. His father made him go to work in a shoe factory, where Williams worked with a man whose name was Stanley Kowalski. He wrote plays while he worked a variety of odd jobs, plays produced by small theater companies, didn't earn him much money. He was nearly broke in 1944 when The Glass Menagerie was produced, a big success, first in Chicago, then on Broadway. 3 years later came A Streetcar Named Desire, with Marlon Brando playing a character named Stanley Kowalski. It's the birthday of Robert Frost, 1874, in San Francisco, moved to Massachusetts when he was 11, struggled to become a poet. He was 39 before he published his first collection of poems, A Boy's Will. Robert Frost, who was out of fashion almost from the beginning, interested in traditional meter and rhyme when his contemporaries were writing in free verse. Early years were rough. Father was a heavy drinker, died of TB when the boy was 12. Family was left impoverished. Frost had to drop out of college during his first year to go to work. He was so depressed at one point he walked into the dismal swamp and considered drowning himself. Taught school for a few years, never enjoyed it. He and his wife Eleanor lost their first child. He fell into despair, barely making ends meet, his marriage on the rocks. That was the year he tried his hand at raising poultry on a 30-acre farm in Derry, New Hampshire. The farm inspired some fine poems, but Frost was a terrible farmer. And it's the birthday of the poet Gregory Corso, born on Bleecker Street in Greenwich Village, New York City, 1930. Gregory Corso, who said, "Standing on a street corner, waiting for no one, is power." His parents were Italian teenagers. Mother went back to Italy, left the baby behind. Corso said, "I never saw my mother. I don't know what happened to her." The father was drafted into the army. The boy spent his childhood in a series of orphanages, foster homes, jails. When he was 16, went to prison for 3 years for stealing food from a restaurant. In 1950, he met the poet Allen Ginsberg. Corso had started writing poetry in prison, and he became one of the leading poets of the Beat movement. Here's a poem by Robert Frost on his birthday, A Prayer in Spring. Oh, give us pleasure in the flowers today, and give us not to think so far away as the uncertain harvest. Keep us here, all simply in the springing of the year. Oh, give us pleasure in the orchard white, like nothing else by day, like ghosts by night, and make us happy in the happy bees, the swarm dilating round the perfect trees. And make us happy in the darting bird that suddenly above the bees is heard, the meteor that thrusts in with needle bill and off a blossom in mid-air stands still. For this is love, and nothing else is love, the which it is reserved for God above to sanctify to what far ends he will, but which it only needs that we fulfill. A Prayer in Spring by Robert Frost, from his collected poems, prose, and plays, published by the Library of America, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Constant Contact, now offering social campaigns, a new tool designed to help small businesses turn fans into customers. Learn more at constantcontact.com. Produced by Kathy Roach, written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Time is 3:44, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guest is Dr. Jenny Fremlin here from Alaska Litho to talk about a seminar on graphic design running with social media. Jenny, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
So you've been giving a lot of these seminars lately.
I have. This will be the sixth one we started last fall.
What was the impetus for doing the one originally?
Well, we actually started with the same one we're ending with, and we introduced a new media services branch of Alaska Litho. So this is sort of our outreach and a way of sharing what media services does. And what we did, we started with start out running with social media, and then we did advanced topics in social media. We did some information on maintaining your own website with WordPress. We did one on government and social media, and then we did content creation. So we did a whole spectrum of trainings on different ways to run your own social media and digital media.
I thought that was something you're never supposed to do, run with scissors. For people who don't have computers or are not familiar with social media, could you describe what social media is, please?
Sure. Well, social media are a range of tools, and they kind of play on the basic human connection that's been around for centuries, just social networking. And it's sort of taking that to a new level by using things like Facebook. That's probably the most popular one. I think 1 in every 8 minutes that Americans spend online is spent on Facebook, so pretty much everyone has heard of that.
What's the best way to use things like Facebook and other social media?
Well, what this seminar covers is how to use it for businesses and organizations. So I talk about how to make sure you have a plan ahead of time and know what you're going to talk about so that you don't end up creating a profile and then not actually using it. And so it's sort of planning ahead and making sure you know who you're talking to and what you're going to share. And then also how to know what it is you want to accomplish so that you can measure those goals and make sure that you're achieving them.
You kind of alluded to this a little bit earlier, but why should people even care about social media?
It's pretty common. It's something that it's a new way that people are connecting, and as a business or an organization, it's a way that people want to connect with you. So it's something that maybe isn't your only outreach method. Of course, you still want to have all of the other media going for you, but it's definitely an important part that plays a role in your changing communication plan. It's a way, it's referred to as pull media instead of push media. So it's a way of putting information out there that people seek out, and then it's available whenever they want it to pull to them instead of broadcast.
What do you say to people who don't think they need it?
Well, if you don't want to do it, you probably shouldn't. You wouldn't have the passion and the engagement with your audience.
Is it difficult?
It doesn't have to be, no. I think that if you plan ahead and know what you want to do, then it can be a pretty easy thing to maintain.
Is this happening this April 6th at Centennial Hall from 1 to 4 p.m.?
Right.
In general, your topics are going to be how to take advantage of social media?
Pretty much. It's centered on digital and social media and things that we're doing in our outreach with the media services. So for media services, we talk about marketing and planning and social media, things that sort of add to your communications plan.
Is there a cost?
It is. It's $95 a person. And you can register online at aklitho.com/register.
And as long as we're here, you could talk about your downtown store a little bit, which has an exhibit of photos coming up in April?
Yeah, we do. The same day after the seminars from 1 to 4, and then starting at 4:30, we have an exhibit of photos. And also, we have a presentation by some students from the CARES program doing some slam poetry and selling their books that we printed.
And I imagine you'd like if people signed up ahead in advance.
Yeah, that'd be great, so that we know how many seats to have.
How can they do that?
For the seminar, They can call us at 586-2174 or go to our website, aklitho.com/register.
Will the handouts be prepared, or should they bring anything in particular?
We have some handouts that have the slides on it and rooms for taking notes, and we also have some notepads and pens that we bring. We have food and snacks, drinks, and there's also some role play and activities, so it's a pretty hands-on seminar.
And Jenny Frimland from Alaska Litho, phone number for people who missed that?
586-2174.
Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Well, I think it's a pretty fun seminar, so hopefully if people missed it back in November, because we actually sold out in November, so they can register ahead of time and make sure they get a seat this time.
All right, Jenny, thank you very much for coming down. Appreciate it.
Great, thank you.
This is Bird Note. The sweet, jumbled song of a house finch is a familiar sound across much of the country. House finches eat many kinds of seeds and fruits. They readily flock to backyard feeders, and their short, thick bills are perfectly designed for hauling sunflower seeds at a brisk pace. Female house finches are brown and heavily streaked overall, while males typically sport a red rump, breast, and headband. But a careful look at male house finches at the feeder shows that while most males show red feathering, some are decidedly more orange, and some even yellow. It turns out that house finches acquire their coloration from pigments in the plant foods they eat. This is true for most birds with red, orange, or yellow pigmented feathers. These tones each derive from a different organic pigment known as carotenoids. So that yellow male house finch standing out from all the red ones? Well, his attire reflects something he ate, or didn't eat. You can listen again to this episode of Bird Note or any other. Even subscribe to the podcast. Begin at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
Time is 3:50 and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. My next guests are Art Roach and Brandon Demmer here to talk about a play that's opening up this weekend, I Am My Own Wife, by playwright Doug Wright. Brandon and Art, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff.
So this happens March 29th through April 1st in McPheeters Hall at Holy Trinity Church. Can you give us an overview of the plot? Is this based on a true story? Is that correct?
It is based on a true story, actually. The subject is someone who existed in Germany during the Nazi regime and then in Eastern Berlin during the communist regime. And this person left us in 2002, and Charlotte von Malsdorf is the name that she went by, was born Lothar Berfelder, and was born a man, and was a gay man who was a transvestite, not a gay man who wanted to become a woman, wanted to become a transsexual, but lived during the Nazi and the communist regimes and survived.
It's amazing that someone with that story could survive those two regimes, not just one, not just the Nazis, right, but the communists too. It's incredible.
This is based on a series of interviews that were done?
That's correct. Doug Wright was vacationing, touring Germany with a good friend of his, by the name of John Marks, who worked for U.S. News and World Report, and they happened upon her museum, which is in Malsdorf, and he was obviously fascinated with the artifacts. She had 18 rooms, and she kept everything from pianolas and all these phonographs and gramophones from a period in German industrial design called the Grundrisse period. And it was just chock full. So it was a 2-hour tour, and she literally went to every object in the 18 rooms and described each one to the tourists. But along this path, along this tour, facts about her life came out, and Doug Wright just jumped all over it because he's a gay man himself, and he grew up in the Bible Belt. And he says in the play, in this letter that he writes to her when he's asking her if he can come over and study her life, you know, I grew up gay in the Bible Belt, but, you know, it's no comparison at all to the Nazis and then the communists. So he was absolutely intrigued and enthralled by this woman and spent 10 years writing this play. And I think even before that, before this play premiered in 2000, I think it was 2003 at New York Theater Workshop, he had written another play called Quills, which some of your listeners may know from a movie that was done. So he was an accomplished writer, but this set him definitely on the map because he ended up winning the Pulitzer and the Tony Award for Best Play, all these international awards as well.
How is the play structured itself?
It's a series of scenes, beginning and ending with Charlotta, and in the series of scenes you follow the path of Doug meeting her and then deciding to write the play and then conducting the interviews and then learning more and more about her. And I think his goal throughout the play is to try and penetrate the mystery of Charlotta and how she survived and what motivates her and what she might have done to survive the Nazis and the communists. She is known to have had some relationship with the Stasi, which are the communist secret police, but it's really, I don't think we'll ever know the extent of her collaboration with them because she passed away without giving, you know, equivocal answers. And there are these great moments where she's confronted with these things and she'll answer questions about the Stasi by telling you how much she loves furniture. And it's really, really profound. It's a great drama, really.
Who else in it? Is just one person playing?
That would be me. Yes.
Brandon plays about 38 characters,
something like that. I don't even want to count.
It's a good thing to not keep track of.
it's daunting. I was just telling Art, my blood pressure is running really, really high, Jeff. It's incredible. So we have a lot of work to do, but we're excited and we're ready for an opening on Thursday.
What inspired you to work on the play?
Actually, the whole idea started with this guy here. Art suggested that I apply for a Rasmussen grant, and I did, and I pitched this idea of touring a show because I'd never done that before, and I wanted a tour. I lived in Skagway for a year and a half before Juno, and I thought, oh, it'd be great to take a show to Skagway. So that led to this idea of what show can I take that would be easy to move around the southeast and maybe up further north to Anchorage and Fairbanks, and I landed upon this show. I actually saw the original production in New York when I was living there on Broadway, and it wasn't until I read it that I really fell in love with it. It's written just beautifully. It's wonderful. And even though it is so daunting that I'm on. I think the first act is about 50 minutes, and the second act is about 40, 45. Mm-hmm. It moves seamlessly from one moment to the next, and in a very interesting way. It's structured just wonderfully, and written very, very, very well.
I think the writing is really extraordinary, and I assume that is a full length one man play, and that to earn the Pulitzer Prize, despite being a one man play, it had to be a little bit better than great. You know what I mean? It had to overcome maybe a little resistance to awarding that prize to a one-man show.
And I think it broke down the notion of a one-person play as in American theater. And the ones that I'm familiar with, and I'm not familiar with a lot of them, they're usually comedic in nature, and it involves a lot of costumes and quick makeup changes and funny hats and noses and whatnot. But here it's one costume. For the most part, I have a different costume at the top of the second act that I remove soon after you see me in it to reveal what you've seen in the first act, which is a simple, well, not so simple. It's a very subtle,
beautiful, severe, yeah. But yeah, really beautiful. It's the kind of clothing costume that Charlotte von Malstorff wore through most of her life. So.
But it's so theatrical because the elements that we've put into this costume fit, hopefully, all of the characters, so that you're not looking at me in a dress the whole time, that it can be transformed by your imagination, the viewer, into a Nazi officer, to a Stasi informant.
Is it terrific costume. Designed by Rick Sela, who also did the costumes for A Raisin in the Sun.
And who's also stage managing.
Mm-hmm. Is it more or less difficult portraying a transvestite on stage, or neither does it matter? It's just one role is a role is a role.
A role is a role, I think. No, I don't think there's any difficulty in. I've actually worn a dress in a play before, so this is not foreign territory to me.
And if people need more information, is there a phone number they can call to get tickets?
You can get tickets through Heartside or the Jack, JHC.org.
Mm-hmm. All right, I've been talking with Art Roach and Brandon Emery about the play "I Am My Own Wife" by Doug Wright. It's performing this 29th through the 1st at McPhee's Hall at Holy Trinity Church. Art and Brandon, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thank you, Jeff. Thanks, Jeff.